Fantasy Sport Pods.
He knew when to turn the dial up on people.
I used to go home and lay there on that settee for 6-7 hours.
I'm now close to 30 years of age and I'm working on things I've never done before.
Welcome to the Premier League Storybook with me, Jake Humphrey. It's time for Chapter 11, The Managers. Now, throughout our journey across the incredible stories of the Premier League, we've heard about the greatest ever teams, from Manchester United through to Arsenal's Invincibles and Chelsea's mid-2000s juggernaut. They're a real mix of teams, huge differences in styles of play, the ways they were assembled, and how they dominated the league in that particular era. But there's one thing all great teams have in common, and that's a manager who creates a perfect blend of tactics and man management to leave rivals in their wake. Today, it seems like managerial appointments are the most important thing for a club to get right, and we've spoken to some top players down the years on all the different managers they've had. However, we couldn't cover this topic without speaking to one of the most charismatic bosses the league has ever seen. Harry Redknapp chatted with me about the pressures of managing at the top level, and while there were some hilarious stories, as you would expect, there were some really touching moments as well. First, though, Arsene Wenger is credited with revolutionising football in this country on and off the pitch. Here's Martin Keown, who was used to the old school at Arsenal, on how Wenger turned the Gunners' training on its head.
Everything was done to a stopwatch. You know, it became a fashionable training session, small-sided game, winning goal, and you could be there 10, 20 minutes, and suddenly the tempo's raised, nobody wants to lose, and the boss would just blow a whistle and say, penalties. I don't want you running around. You've all given too much. If we're going to stay out here another 10 or 15 minutes. We were a little bit angry with that, but we were kind of like left with that feeling of wanting more. I just felt that every session was enjoyable. Suddenly that mannequins appeared and then backboards. We were practicing weight of pass, clipping balls over mannequins for Dennis Bergkamp to peel off a defender. There was a link that I'd never really worked on before, things I'd never done. I'd never seen a mannequin. I'm now close to 30 years of age and I'm working on things I've never done before. Almost felt like a golfer clipping balls onto the green. And then come Saturday, I think, well, I've done this all week. Do you know, I'm just going to clip this over the defence and Dennis will run onto it. And it just seemed to happen for us in front of our eyes. But he gave us that belief, Arsene Wenger. And I think coupled with the George Graham approach, which was, I suppose, in all of us, those two things together was a perfect unity of how we could go on and be successful, because those players from abroad, shall we say, came in with great talent, added to, we were a bit more conservative in terms of how we wanted to play. Wenger wanted us to really get forward and be expressive in the way that we played, which is the key to all this, what you do on the pitch, ultimately. And we were a little bit more guarded. And maybe that in those early years, when we were a little, holding that defence, squeezing, pushing up from the back, organising in front, there was a really good balance between Wenger wanting to play beautiful football, but at the same time you had a little bit of that George Graham feeling that, no, we need to get this right first.
Now, before we hear from Harry Redknapp, let's pay tribute to his famous production line of young players at West Ham. Joe Cole was the jewel in the crown at Upton Park as a young teenager and has nothing but praise for the man who gave him his debut.
Harry, we talked about Graham Potter and his, emotional intelligence, course and doing that, learning it. Harry would have learnt that way with people through his life. It's a hard thing to calculate emotion, but in terms of knowing how to get the best out of a younger player, a player on his way down, a player of injuries, when to push, when not to push. Harry was a genius at that, In a time where football tactics was less pronounced, there wasn't much going on in the English game, I don't think, tactics-wise, from the late 80s through to right the way through the 90s. I thought, you look at football now and Harris is... So it's hard to judge him tactically because he was as good as anyone in his time, but he was the best man manager you would ever see. And the biggest, people at the FA should hang their heads in shame that he wasn't an England manager when he could have been on a couple of occasions, because he would have done a great job.
So what's it really like to be a Premier League boss? Well, let's ask someone who's managed 641 games in the division. Take it away, Harry Redknapp.
I want to talk about when you took the West Ham job in the early 90s. So you'd done a long time in the Football League with Bournemouth. Can you explain to us the difference when you went to West Ham?
Well, it was a big difference, obviously, because, you know, at Bournemouth for 10 years, it was an amazing experience. I mean, we had no training ground. We would train in the park in the mornings, get thrown off by the park keeper half hour after we'd started. He'd come around on the bike and throw us off. You know, every day was the same, trying to beg and find somewhere to train, borrowing, going to the local park and asking somebody in Fording Bridge, which was about 50-minute drive away, if we could train on the field there, you know, and put some posts down and just make a... Every day was difficult. You know, we beat Man United in the FA Cup on the Saturday when I managed Bournemouth. On the Monday, there was a red grass, red ochre, cinder pitch, whatever you'd call it. One of the staff came and said, the gate's unlocked on the cinder pitch outside the ground. Belonged to the council. So I said, well, let's go on there and have a nine aside this. Everyone was in great spirits, just beat Man United 2-0. They were cup holders. We were a struggling third division team. We went on there and started playing. We'd been on there about 35 minutes, I suppose, and suddenly the park keeper locked us in, put the bolt on the door, padlocked it and just locked us in there. We had to climb over the fence, which was about 20 foot high, to get out of there. I mean, seeing me try to get over that fence that day was... It was unbelievable. But that brought us back, and that's how it was in them days. So it was very different. Going to West Ham, back to where I grew up, back to Chadwell Heath, back to the old training ground. It was fantastic, you know. And the first thing I did was try to get the club back to producing some players again, which is what happened in all my time there. It was a conveyor belt of producing kids at the East End of London to play for West Ham. Bobby Moore and Jeff and Martin playing the World Cup final. Trevor Brooking came from Ilford, you know, Frank Lampard from Canning Town. Everybody came from within the area. And that was the first thing I said, we've got to start producing some players again. We've gone 11 years without finding a player, really, that had played a few games, you know, since Ince and Cotty and Potsy. We'd gone all them years without producing a player.
So let's talk then about a couple of those young players. I mean, let's talk about Rio Ferdinand. When did you first become aware of what you had on your hands with him?
Well, we had a guy bring a team over to players. He came from South London area. He was just, you know, worked at the schools and that. And so he had an in to the kids. So we ended up giving him a little job and a little bit, you know. Suddenly he rings up one day and so I've got a kid here. He's just turned up for a trial for the town team. He said he looks fantastic. He said he's never been anywhere, never played anywhere. He's a late player, you know, sort of wasn't really, I think his mum wanted him to be a dancer, apparently. Not really, you know, there's no one after him. I think you should have a look at him. So we got him down training. He came in and my God, we thought, what is this kid? He's a proper player. Millwall came on the scene suddenly then. So it was us and Millwall. There was no Tottenham's, Arsenal, Chelsea. They didn't know about him. And then it became a straight fight between us and Millwall, really. And then we convinced him that West Ham was the club for him to join. And he came in his first game. I never forget it. I was away, I think, at Newcastle that night with the first team. And my dad rung, I was on the way home, and we'd played the second leg of this. I think it was a Southern Junior Cup final. We got well beat in the first leg. I think we went to the second leg 2 goals behind from the home leg. And the second leg, my dad went everywhere to watch football. And he'd been over to Chelsea, jumped on the train, went to Chelsea. And he said, Harry, so I've seen one of the best players I've seen in years tonight playing in your youth team, a kid in midfield. I said, who was that, Frank? He went, no, another boy called Ferdinand. I said, no, he couldn't have played, Dad. I said, he's still at school. He's still a schoolboy. He played. He's a big, tall boy. He said, kept picking out, running 40, 50 yards with it, going past 3 or 4, gliding past people. I said, you sure? He said, yeah, I'm sure, you know? Hey, all right, great, oh, well. And we won the game that night. We actually won it 6-5, I think, on aggregate. Anyway, 10 minutes later, Tony Carter, youth team coach, rings me on the coach, and he said, Harry, I said, Tony, you won, what a result. He said, yeah. I said, who done well? I said, my dad just rang me. He said, Harry, Rio Ferdinand was just incredible. I said, really? And that was it, really. That was the start of realising what we had on our hands, you know?
Wow. And you mentioned Frank Lampard as well, who's your nephew, of course. And I remember watching that clip. I think we spoke about it when we worked together at BT Sport, about a supporter questioning him being in the side ahead of Scott Canham. Tell me your memories of that incident, but also how early you recognised that Frank had something a little bit different to everybody else.
Well, I couldn't say that, you know, Frank wasn't, he wasn't a kid that you looked at and thought, my God, he's a cert to be a player. Like Rio came, he was a Rolls Royce. Joe Cole was the best schoolboy player I'd ever seen. Frank had this great attitude. He just wanted to be a player. And when I took him, the people at West Ham, in fact, said to me, Harry, he's never going to make a player. He can't run. He can't get around the pitch. How's he ever going to be a player, you know? But he had this, he had an attitude to, and a willing, you know, the will to succeed and train and work. I've never seen anybody in my whole life train like it. The only person I've ever seen come near him would have been his dad, who had the same message given to him when he was 15, when he was 16, 17, and they were let him go to Torquay. He came back every afternoon, put his spikes on, did sprints, got quicker and quicker and quicker. Young Frank did the same, got a pair of spikes, he'd do his sprints, 10, 15, sharp ones every day after training, get a bag of balls, shooting, left foot, right foot, all night. I'd look out my office at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, dark, middle of winter, and it'd be Frank would be out there on his own, raining, no matter what the weather, hitting balls up to a cone, bang, 20 yards, left foot, right foot, collecting the balls, go again, do his sprints. Every single day was the same. And so I knew that with that determination, he couldn't fail, you know. I couldn't sit here and say I thought, oh, yeah, he would definitely go on and play 100 and whatever times for England and score 20 goals every year from midfield in the Premier League. I'd be a liar if I said that. But I knew he certainly had a future in the game because of his attitude, really.
So interesting. And let's talk about your approach then to young players, because also in that clip, you called the three players absolutely spot on when they were all teenagers. Scott Canham, who kind of faded away. Matt Holland, he had a good career. And Frank has become an all-time great. So when did you feel like you had a natural gift for not just spotting talent, but working with them and getting the best out of them?
Well, I'd always, you know, obviously, I think when you come through, and my own boy plays as well, obviously. So I think that, you know, I talked to youth. I remember doing a show with you, and before we went on talking to Steven Gerrard when he first got involved at Liverpool under 18s. You know, I said, Stevie, every day have a chat with them, two or three. Have a chat with them kids. Talk to them. How are things at home? How are the digs? They might be in digs with them. How are things there? You know, everything okay? Talk to them about their game. Spend a bit of time each day. Maybe take two or three or one of them aside, spend a bit of time, couple each day, work on what they do in a game, whether it's crossing, whether it's passing, you know, and talk to them, make them feel that you're shown that you're really interested in their future. They'll ring up their mum and dad, they'll say, hey, Stevie had a chat with me today. You know, he's worked with me on my left foot, he worked on crossing or he worked on whatever. You would make them kids feel so important, and that is what it's about. People making you feel important. We all have a pat on the back, and there's nothing gets more out of people than encouraging them and telling them what they can do and taking an interest in them. Like Frank took in young Frank, obviously he had his dad there as well. And I've seen it before. You had a boy at Norwich all them years ago called Kevin Bond, whose dad really at the time when he came to Bournemouth, I could never have seen him being a player in a million years, Kevin. His dad believed in him. And he had someone that took an interest, obviously, through it. And he ended up making it. He was given the time, but he was also, you know, someone who believed in him and his dad. And he worked at his game and went on, you know, years later, he may end up player of the year at Man City, player of the year at Southampton. His dad wasn't managing him then, you know. But people always go, oh, it's because his dad was the manager. But again, he had a great attitude and had someone who believed in him. And I think that's important. Take an interest. Don't group them kids together every day. Don't get 16 of them and all do a bit of training and then, okay, off you go. But talk to them. Get into their heads. Get to know them. Make them feel important. Make them show them that you're interested in them. How are you? How's life? Everything okay? Got any problems? No problems. You know, and work on little bits each day. Pull two or three aside and show a real interest in them. And you'll give them every chance to become a player.
There's also, though, a conversation to be had here about balance, isn't there? Because you were smart to understand that young talent at West Ham is a really important part of that football club. But you need to marry that up with experience as well. So you re-signed, didn't you, quite quickly? Julian Dix and Tony Cotty came back to the football club. How do you get the balance right, do you think, in top-flight management when it comes to youth and experience? And how did you go about dealing with it?
It was very different then, though, because the kids would train at the same place. We'd all be at the same training ground. So every morning we'd start training and you might have a little injury and you call one of the kids over and they'd come and join the first team group, you know. Or maybe some days you take a couple at the start to make the numbers up so they've got the feel of it. And every day I'd like to introduce one or two of them to train with the first team. And that made them, you know, you see where they were when they came over with the first team. Remember Glenn Johnson coming over when he was 15 and working training with the first team. And I think that's important, you know, make them feel. But you do want, you want good pros. If you've got good senior pros at your club, it's such a help to have been producing kids, you know, the knowledge that they can pass on, keeping them on the right track. Yeah, and that's what we had. When I went to West Ham at 15, I mean, it was incredible the amount of, you know, Kenny Brown and John Bond who end up. You had people like Malcolm Allison. You had, you know, it was Dave Sexton, you know, Frank O'Farrell managed Man United. All people that went on to manage it, you know, manage, become great managers, were all at that football club. And they would, you know, they'd talk football and you would be around them. You could hear them in the calf talking and moving pepper pots about. That was how it was in them days. Every, you know, the senior players really would pass their knowledge on to the kids. They would have, that was the most important thing. It was more important than coaching, really. Just little bits of knowledge they could give you. You know, it was just so important.
And let's talk about perception in management, Harry, because it was very interesting when, you know, we had our time working together. You'd suddenly have a manager like Jurgen Klopp would come over to the Premier League and bring what he called heavy metal football. You know, that gegenpress, pressing immediately from the front. And I remember you saying to me, I don't understand what the fuss is about. I was getting my teams to press the opposition 20 years before. Or I remember a period where it was the transfer window and we were on BT and we got some questions in from people at home saying, oh, you know, Harry was a great Wheeler dealer, ask him this or that. And you say, I was not a Wheeler dealer. Like I just bought players like every other manager did.
Yeah.
What did you make of that? Let's do that one first, that Wheeler dealer conversation. What did you make of that reputation? Where do you think that came from?
I didn't like it because, you know, I got my coaching badge at 21. I love coaching. I used to go into schools in the afternoon, coach kids when I was playing at West, a young player. And I loved coaching. That's what I've always enjoyed. I've always gone to clubs where they've been struggling. And that's why you get the job. You know, wherever I've been, you walk in, even at Tottenham, where great, I walked into Tottenham, they had great players. They shouldn't, but at the end of the day, they were still stuck at the bottom of the league when I went there. And so you look at it, well, hang on. I love coaching, but also they're not bottom of the league because they need some improvement. So you'd go out and try to change one or two when the window opened and get one or two new players in and change things around and also work on the training ground room. So I didn't like that. It was as though, you know, yeah, because I've got a Cockney accent, you know, I was a Cockney Wheeler dealer, which, yeah, I did find it used to annoy me, I must be honest.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because it's so much about perception. If you're coming to English football, Harry, with a sharp suit on and a, you know, a Portuguese or a Spanish accent, the perception of you is very different. And I think sometimes we think that, you know, managers from abroad have brought these amazing ideas to English football and we laud them and celebrate them. And people like you are sitting there thinking, well, we have been doing that for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, we did back in the day, people didn't press. They used to tackle you. It didn't go there and pressure and close. So when the ball came, someone would lift your 6 foot in the air. If you was a winger, as soon as that ball came to you, a fullback, even like back in the day, a Pierce Stewart, the Stuart Pierces of this world, as soon as the ball arrived to that winger, Pierce would be lifting him 6 foot in the air. You know, so that's more than pressing. That ain't just pressing. That is getting there and being there on the front foot, making a tackle, stopping him even getting the ball. As soon as his first touch, bang, he's hitting him, you know? That was real pressure to play under. Not just someone pressuring you and closing you and then sort of staying on, you know, making it difficult. They were coming in and really you were getting hammered. So if your first touch wasn't spot on, you were banging trouble, you know. But no, that was, it was the perception. I remember doing a press conference, picking up the paper on the Monday morning, and the guy, I can't get his name, I still see him, and every time I see him, I laugh. I say the same. He said, Arsene Wenger came in and had a suit on that was obviously made in Savile Row or whatever, you know. Harry Redknapp came in to do his press conference in a suit that he probably bought on in Romford Market. I mean, absolutely. And, you know, it was, yeah, it was funny. But that was how it was, you know. But so, yeah, it was difficult at times. It used to annoy me, but, you know, at the end of the day, as long as you know what you're doing and what you are, you can look in the mirror and think, no, I know what I'm doing. I know I'm going every day. You don't manage the amount of games I managed if you're just a wheeler dealer, that's for sure.
100%. And did you enjoy this influx of foreign influence into the Premier League, whether it was in the dugout as managers or whether it was with players?
Yeah, well, I think once the window, once it opened up and we started, you know, the canny, you know, the great players who went to Chelsea, the Zolas and, you know, Rudol, incredible talent coming into the game, you know. And I took Di Canio, who was an amazing player at West Ham, probably the biggest, you know, one of the biggest gambles certainly I've ever took in football, really. He'd just coming back from the ban when he pushed Mr. Alcott, the referee, over. And he had a long ban for that. And people said I was crazy. There was a headline in the in one of the Sunday newspapers saying I was walking the tightrope with no safety net under me signing to Canio. But he was a genius, and it was a gamble. But there was. Listen, we were taking chances in them days. We were somewhere. Some of them were same as now. Some come off, some don't. Because you don't really, back in the day when I managed at Bournemouth, you'd ring another manager up who had managed a player before maybe. And you say, Joe, tell me about it. What's he like? And they'd give you an honest opinion. They say, no, Harry, don't touch him, mate. He's aggro. He's not good around the place. He's a bad trainer. He don't do this. He don't do that. You know, he's not going to help your team. And lovely, thanks, Ray, mate. Don't mention I told you. But you could do that. You could do that. Because everybody came from England, came from Britain. You know, we're all British players. Suddenly you got the foreign players in. You were going in, taking people. You didn't really know anything about their character. You had nobody to check them out with. And you were taking chances. And some came off, as I say, and some didn't come off. And every club had success and failure. You know, we all did. I don't care whether you're at Sir Alex, you know, Man United. He had a few that didn't. But it was different. I think when you was at the top and you're winning every week, winning the leagues, you can make a ricket and do £1 million. No one ever picks it up. It don't matter. You're still winning. When you're struggling, you spend £500,000-£600,000 on someone who don't come off. You're banging in trouble because you're a middle of the road team and not got the resources that Man United or someone have got. So you were under more pressure. But yeah, some were great, some didn't come off, but it changed everything in lots of ways. That, you know, the attitude of the foreign player, the way they looked after themselves, the way they prepared for a game. They didn't drink, they ate the right foods, they were indifferent, they stretched right, they warmed up right. It was very, very different to what we'd been used to in England, you know, and I think they changed really the culture of the English game in lots of ways with the way they, with the professionalism that they showed and they've been brought up with.
Let's talk then about a couple that didn't quite come off signings-wise and how quickly you understand that maybe this isn't going to work. Who springs to mind when I talk about signings from abroad that it just doesn't deliver what you were hoping?
Oh, Marco Bugas, I took from, he came from Holland, from a Dutch club. He was a player that, again, it was a video. I was ill. I couldn't go to work for a couple of days, and someone recommended a player to me called Marco Bugas. Anyway, the video, I looked at the video. I sent him to the training ground, had a look at the video. They liked it. I liked it. He looked all right, scoring goals, £700,000. We were desperate for a striker, and I took a gamble with him. I'm not saying he wouldn't have been a decent player, but for whatever reason, he suddenly disappeared and went off to live in a caravan somewhere. I think they're still probably looking for him at West Ham. I don't know what happened to him.
Is that right? Well, he went he went off and lived in a caravan while still playing for you.
He suddenly disappeared and we don't know where he went. And about 2 months later, I think we found him and he's back in Holland. He wouldn't come back. So we ended up having to sell him for what we could to a Dutch club who knew the situation. So we were in trouble, obviously, you know, because he weren't going to come home or come back to West Ham. And we had to get what we could for him. And obviously we took a bit of a knock on him.
You know, I had a look before we spoke about him. And, you know, he went off and played in the end for FC Dordrecht in Holland again. He scored a goal every other game.
Right.
he scored 162 goals in 350 games.
Yeah, no, he looked, you know, when you saw him, you could see he could play. He got sent off in his first game. He kicked Gary Neville. That was the only thing I do forgive him for. and he got sent off. But... yeah, he's only been on the pitch about 10 minutes.
And what about Florin? Is it Raducio? How do you say his surname? Florin?
Yeah, you probably pronounce it, but Florin Raducio. Raducio. Yeah, whatever.
So you bought him from Espanyol, didn't you?
He was the golden boot, I think, in the World Cup. Played at Milan, played his first game at West Ham was away at Torquay United in a pre-season friendly. We'd gone down the West Country to play 3 games. And he'd come in at half-time and said, "They're kicking me, they're kicking me." They had a centre-half called Giddins, a big, strong centre-half who'd been at Southampton. And he was a bit aggressive. And he gave him a couple of whacks. And I said, "Listen, wait till you play against Tony Adams. This, you know, this is England." But he couldn't handle it, really. And... So he was a bit of a disaster.
He didn't play many games for you, did he?
No, not many at all. Other people liked him at the club. I don't know, maybe I made my mind up too quickly about him after that night. I thought, oh, my God, I'm not sure. But he certainly had a bit of game. If you look at his record, he played at top clubs, you know, and played in that Romanian team that was a really good team.
And so when you make these big shouts as a manager and spend someone else's money and it doesn't come off, how did you learn to deal with the pressure from the media, the pressure from the fans, and also, of course, the pressure from the boardroom as well? How big a process was that you had to go through before you were comfortable with the intense pressure of top-flight management?
Well, I think that when you're winning, I don't think it matters. I think you get nothing said. If things are going okay, they sort of get pushed into the background. Now, he's gone, but forget all about him. But when you're struggling, then it gets, oh, you've wasted, £1 million on a rubbish player. It really gets highlighted, you know. So what can you do? It was all a gamble. We didn't have the same. And as I say, when you're taking foreign players, it was a gamble because when do you get to watch them play, really? How often can you watch them? I watched him play in the World Cup, you know. But how often can you get over there and watch them? You're playing Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday. They're playing Saturday or Sunday. You know, you're signing players now, suddenly the players have come. So that's why now managers really have very little say at the top level in who comes in. It's all done by heads of recruitment. They've all watching videos. They're all analysts. The manager really had very little say in who they buy in these. And really doesn't get much chance to watch them play because... You're playing every Saturday midweek, so you really don't get an opportunity to watch these players. You're taking gambles on other people's say-so, really.
And tell me how supportive managers are to each other. Like, were there managers who you really would lean on for advice and help?
Oh, back in them days, yeah. I think we all stuck together. At the end of the season, we'd all go to Lillyshaw. There'd be a managers and coaches call, so it was the best week of the year. We'd have coaches come in from, do different sessions and it was fantastic. We'd all go to the pub at night, talk football, talk all day. You were around managers and coaches. Malcolm Allison would be there holding court. Jackie Charlton would be arguing with whoever Charles used or whoever was putting on a session, defending corners. Jack would rip him to pieces for an hour and tell him what he was doing didn't work and you can't do it this way. And you, as a young manager, it was just a fantastic experience to be around all these people every day. As I was saying, at night, you'd be at the pub talking football, nothing but football. And that was how it was. We all, because we were all British managers. and we all knew each other. We'd all come through the system, all played football, or went, you know, played a bit or whatever we'd done. It wasn't, and there was no, after a game, there was no TV to do. You'd do a quick press conference, you know, quick chat with the local paper, and then it was done. And you were back in your office at 5 to 5, and the other manager would come in. You sit and have a glass of wine and chat for half hour. You jump and go and get on the coach and go home. It was, now you don't get a chance to meet other managers. You know, you've got the press, you've got the TV, you've got interviews galore. And but that takes probably an hour after before. And by then you've got a flight to catch. Now they fly everywhere in the Premier League, so they've got a flight to catch. So the days are gone where you could go and sit in the manager's office because you had no press to do, and have a glass of wine and sit and have a chat. And then the old trainer would come in. We've ordered a fish and chips, Gaffer. We've got to pick them up at 5:45. You know, we better go. And you'd go and get on the coach, get the fish and chips on the way home, and have a 5 or 6 hour coach journey over to Newcastle or somewhere. Suddenly it all changed. And you really didn't get to talk to the other managers quite the same or spend time with them. There's no managers and coaches courses anymore at Lily Shaw like we used to go to. So really, yeah, you don't really get to know each other like you did back in the day.
You know, people talk often, don't they, about red wine with Sir Alex Ferguson, for example. Like, would you actually have a proper drink and a really good catch-up after a game with him, either, you know, at West Ham or up at Man United?
Always, 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 you know, go in and have a glass of wine. Even before a game, I go and have a cup of tea at 2:10 when the teams went out for a warm-up. That 40 minutes is the loneliest 40 minutes of all. You're sitting in that dressing room on your own. Everything's done. You've worked all week on what you're doing. You've got their team coming at 2:00. You get the team. You put the team up. Yeah, it's the team we've been looking for, it would be more or less. You know, you put the team up on the board. You board a set plays. Listen, he's not playing. So we're saying you pick him up. You're going to pick him up. You're doing near post space. You're still there. All what we'd worked on. And then the players would go out for that warm-up that they were the fitness coaches. And I used to go in Alex's room and have a cup of tea and have a chat. I'll be honest, we might even watch the racing or watch a bit of the early games coming, finishing the score. And we'd chat football. And he was like me. He knew every team. He could tell you how Stockport were getting on, or Rochdale, how they were doing in the league. And I was exactly the same. You know, I just loved following every game. We knew every player. And that was what we had in common, really. We both, you know, come through the ranks and had a real love of the game.
I wonder whether you would enjoy the job as much these days as you did back in those days, where you're not really responsible for the signings. It is a very different job. You're pretty much a coach rather than a manager, and there isn't this necessarily a real camaraderie between people doing the same job as you.
No, I don't think I would. It was certainly, that was what made it, and certainly back in the early days, you know, the Bournemouth days, when you get in your car every night and drive somewhere to watch a game. And that's what I did. I'd drive down to Plymouth, I'd go to Newport, and, you know, and go in there and sign Tony Pulis on a free transfer from Newport County. And I get to the game, it's taking me 3 hours to drive, it's raining, a lot of games being called off. I'll get there 20 minutes before kickoff, and they've got a little old shed there where the coaches, you know, the scouts and whoever can go and have a cup of tea. And I walk in, gone to watch Tony play, and he's in there having a cup of tea. And I end up tapping him up there instead. He said, listen, get me. I'd love to. I took him on a free transfer, you know. But that was how it was. Every night you went to a game, you went and watched a game of football somewhere, and it was different. And you failed or you succeeded on your own signings. They were your opinions. I bought him in. It's no good. I hold my hand up. Nowadays, I think it's very different. They're being signed by it. But when it goes wrong, you never see anybody get the blame except the manager. They get the blame. It's not, they don't sack other people. They, you know, and what you do find lots of times with people who are in charge of recruitment, they always pipe up and let you know, I recommended him. They never tell you about the ones they didn't recommend that were no good. That's always down to the manager.
Let's talk about the manager, you know, the buck stops there and leaving clubs. Can you explain to us why you ended up leaving West Ham? Because that day in 2001, no one really seemed quite sure what had happened.
No, I still don't know really what happened. I mean, I was, you know, Terry Brown had wanted me to sign a new 4-year contract, and it had been sitting there for about 6 months. And I was, you know, it was no rush to do it. I felt comfortable. Everything was great for me there. Mick Maguire, who was at the PFA, Mick was did my contract for me. And Mick said, Harry, come, we've got to get down and get this contract signed, you know? Yeah, no problem, Mick. You know, I said to Terry Brace, I want you for the next 10 years. Not, I remember him saying to me, not the next 4 years. And then sadly, Mick rung me and said, Harry, we were going to go down that week. He said, what have you done? I said, I don't know. He said, you said something about the chairman. He don't like it. He's got the ump here. I said, really? I said, I better go and see him in the morning. And I popped in to see him. And yeah, I think I spoke to a fanzine and, you know, I think I'd said one or two things and that I felt I was talking to a mate in the pub or somewhere, or whatever, and he wrote it word for word and it didn't come out great. So that was it. And I think Terry was very upset. He'd showed, you know, had a lot of faith in me, treated me well. And I think really I said a few things that I shouldn't have said about him. And that was it, really.
And did you want to leave?
Because no.
I did look at the statement you put out when you left and you said, it's been a tough few weeks. I feel it's time for a change. I mean, that's just what you put on a statement, right? To stop any questions, I suppose.
Yeah, probably. I would think you say what, yeah. But no, I didn't want to leave. No way. No way. No, I was, you know, I had them kids coming through, didn't I? And they were fantastic young players there. And no, there was no way I certainly ever wanted to leave West Ham. You know, I've never wanted to leave anywhere, really, to be honest. I mean, you know, when people get rid of you, it comes out the blue, it's a shot. You know, a lot of the time you don't see it coming. I certainly didn't see it coming there. And, you know, but that's how it goes, you know. And things changed when I left. I think there was a lot of chat. They decided that, you know, they weren't going to let anybody into what's training anymore and different, you know. It changed a little bit, the club, for a few years. But, no, I loved my time there, obviously.
How painful was it for the chairman to say there's no new contract?
Oh, yeah, very painful. Yeah, I was choked. Yeah, I really was hurt. You know, I'd grown up there and, you know, to have stayed there as long as I did and felt that we was on the verge of having a very, very good team. So it was hurtful for sure. It was painful, but probably learned a lesson, you know. Keep my mouth shut a bit more.
And how close did you ever come to going back there? There was always, whenever a manager left West Ham, there's always a newspaper story about Harry Redknapp's being discussed in the boardroom or whatever. Was there ever a conversation?
No, never. No, I think once I'd gone, that was it, really. I went from there to Portsmouth, met Milan Mandrick, and Milan was looking for a director of football. And so I got a phone call. Would I be interested in being... I said, I don't really know what it involves, you know. I've never been a director of football. And so he wanted to meet me. I met him at the Chewton Glen Hotel in the New Forest. And we sat down and got on great. And he wanted me to go there straight away, offered me the job. And I went there, but I really didn't even know what my role was. I ended up being Milan. We was like, we were like the odd couple. Graham Ricks was the manager, good young manager. But I hadn't done anything to Graham. I didn't want to be manager of Portsmouth. That was no way ever on my agenda. I went there, really. I saw it as a stopover, you know, saying until something else comes up. And Graham came out and said, I wasn't allowed at the training ground. And I thought, well, it's good. I've not even met him, you know. He didn't see me being part of, you know. So that was it, really. So we never went, me and Milan, I'd pick him up in the mornings, we'd go and have a coffee and sit and have a chat for an hour. And then we'd, you know, I'd drive him to the games away from home. And that was, that was it, really. I got offered the Leicester job about 2 months after that. I went up to Leicester, met John Elson, the chairman. He offered me the job there. I think Peter Taylor had just left. He offered me the job. I drove back home. I don't know, really. I wanted to go there. You know, Martin had done a great job, Martin O'Neill, previously to that, and he was in a bit of a line. And I didn't take it, and so I stayed at Portsmouth. It was interesting times, but I really missed the management. You know, that was really, you know, being a day-to-day, being on the pitch, on the training ground, that's what I enjoyed the most.
Because you weren't very old then. You would have been like, you know, 45 or whatever. So what were you like... Even longer, maybe 42, 43. What were you like around the house and things when you were out of a job?
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, I wasn't out long, though.
Yeah.
That was, you know, it was. I sort of went to Portsmouth really on the rebound, you know, of West Ham. And then sort of at the end of that season, the club was in the bottom three, looked like it might go down. Milan said to me, he'd let Graham Ricks go. And he said to me, would you take the last three or four games of the season? He said, if you don't do it, Harry, I'll probably pack up and one thing and another. And so I took it and we managed to scramble our way out of trouble and stayed up. And then the following year, he asked me to be the manager. And I don't want to be disrespectful to Portsmouth, but it wasn't something that really I was too crazy about at that time. They'd been in the bottom six, I think, the previous 5 years. Now, I couldn't see anywhere they were going to go out of that. Milan wasn't spending money. The club, the ground was, old. There was no training ground at all. We never had anywhere to train. They used to use a place that was an old Navy place that had an oak tree in the middle of a bit of a football pitch. They had old outdoor changing rooms that were, it was no showers, no. And I thought, there's no future here. But, I went in the following year, he begged me to take the job, else he definitely was going to pack up. And I took it so I signed for a year. I'll give it a year. I took a year, and I went, that summer, I went and found a training ground at Southampton's old training ground. They bought a new one, and I went to the old one. And I asked who it belonged to. It belonged to the university, and they said we could have it. They weren't mad to have us there, but they said, look, the only thing is we've got a cricket square. You can have a little bit over there, a little bit over there. So you had enough to play a 7-8-a-side game over there and one over there. But on Wednesdays, you have to be off the premises by 11 o'clock. That's not off the pit, that's out the premises because it's hockey and cricket day. So we'd come in and train, start up past 8-9 o'clock on Wednesday morning, do an hour and a half, up past bang. Everybody had to be out the building by 11. And suddenly, the place used to flood. We ended up training in the park across the road where they played Sunday morning football. It was about 20 pitches in this big old open area. And I've got people like Teddy Sheringham and people like that coming, Patrick Berger. And they've got no hot showers, no hot water. And we're training across the road on pitches they've been playing Sunday morning on. But no one ever complained. They got on with it and it was an amazing time in my life, that Portsmouth thing. We the following year, my first year in charge, we won the championship. We got promoted. I signed Paul Merson, who turned everything around, and away we went. And it was just a great time for me.
It's fantastic. Can we roll the clock forwards a bit to you being the last English manager to win a trophy, which was the FA Cup in 2008? Why do you think that is?
Well, I just think you never get a chance, an English British manager to manage a top four team. When the jobs come up, no one ever seemed to get a mention. And I went to a big club, good club in Tottenham, and I had a chance to manage a top four team. But before that, obviously, I got to the cup final, won the cup with Portsmouth, because you very rarely get a chance to manage a top four team. That's just the way it is. If you look over the years, the top teams that have got a chance of winning anything really are always, always managed by foreign managers. The English, British managers never seem to get that opportunity for whatever reason.
Why though? Why not?
No, why not? I don't know. They're all managed by, all owned by foreign owners, the clubs. And you can't tell me there's not some great talent around in the lower divisions and in the Premier and the lower, give them the opportunity. They could win trophies galore, but they just don't give them the opportunity.
Let's talk about Tottenham now. What was going through your mind when you took that job?
Well, it was a difficult one. I turned the job down about 18 months earlier. I went and met Daniel Levy at his house. I got a phone call. He wanted me to go and manage Tottenham. I went and met him. First night, I sat with him for about 5 hours chatting football. He wanted me to go there. He wanted me there straight away. I went back the following, the following night he wanted to see me again. He came with Daniel Camoli this time. And the two of them sat chatting to me about, and Martin Jol was the manager. And I said to him, I don't know why you're changing your manager. You're doing, Martin Jol's a very popular manager. I said, I don't think I'm not going to be a popular signing because, they like Martin quite rightly. He's doing a good job. they said, well, Daniel said, no, well, we want to change and we want you to come. And I said, at the moment, I don't think it's right. I'd rather leave it now. I'd say, let's see how we go in a month or two, if things change and things are... And they went on a decent run and they was okay. And so it sort of drifted away. But the job was mine, there was no doubt. And then 18 months later, we played in Braga with in the UEFA Cup or the Cup Winners' Cup with Portsmouth. And I remember getting on the coach and this phone went, and it was Daniel again asking me, would I go there? And I went and met him that night when I got back from Portugal, and I took the job. And on the Sunday, was in the dugout for the first seat. I said, listen, Daniel, I've got a problem. He said, what? I said, I can't take the job today. This was on a Saturday. He said, I want you in the dugout tomorrow, Harry. I want you in the dressing room. We had a horrendous start. I need you tomorrow. I said, I can't. I said, I'm getting the Freedom of the City of Portsmouth on Monday. I said, I can't go and get the Freedom of the City. It's a big, big, big ceremony. It's going to be hundreds of people there. It's all a dignitary, and I'm going to get the Freedom of Portsmouth. I can't leave Portsmouth and come in. I said, I'll have to wait till after Monday. He said, no, we can't. You've got to do it today. I can't wait. We can't go. Anyway, I ended up taking it. And so Monday was a very uncomfortable day going back to Portsmouth to get the Freedom of the City.
So you have still got the Freedom?
I did, yeah. It was a big public ceremony. All the dignitary, all dressed up. And I said, my opening words were, my timing never has been very good. But and that was it. Off I went. It was one or two up in the public gallery who weren't too happy that I throw them out. They were giving me a bit of abuse, you know. But other than that, it went okay.
And so did your time at Tottenham. I mean, let's talk about that second season when you took them back into the Champions League. And you had those really difficult results, didn't you, at the end of that season? Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City. And you had to deliver in those games. What are your memories of those final few matches trying to get Spurs back into the elite European competition?
Well, it was, I mean, going to Man City was a winner-take-all game. It was us or them. And a draw really wouldn't have done us because I think they had better goal difference or whatever. So we had to go there and try to win. And even though I only ended up 1-0, I went there and played with an attacking team, played two up front and went for it, really. And Crouchy scored the goal and we ended up, it was a great night for us, you know, to be back in Europe or to be in the, you know, Champions League was fantastic. The following year, I remember the draw being made. We drew Young Boys of Bern in the first round and it was so when the draw was made in the qualifying, because we finished fourth in the league, the draw was made and we got Young. Now there's no time I can go and see them because the only time they're playing is on the Saturday before. And we're playing on the Saturday in the league. So Clive Allen went for me. And Clive came back and said, Harry, they're poor team, bang average. He said, we'll have no problem with them. I said, well, let's hope so. Anyway, we were 3-0 down in 20 minutes. And then they hit the crossbar to go 4 up. I couldn't tell you what I said to Clive in the dugout at that time. I couldn't repeat it. But yeah, we ended up coming back, getting a couple of goals back and then came home and beat them comfortably at home to get ourselves into the first round proper, you know, into the knockout stages. So, yeah, it was fantastic. The music, you know, that made the ears stand up on the back of your neck when you hear Champions League football. It's such a special, there's nothing like it really, is there? That when that music plays and with all, I'd watched it over the years and then to be involved in it and going to the San Siro to play, it was fantastic.
Yeah, let's talk then about, you know, that amazing 3-1 dismantling of Inter Milan and that team that you put together that you took into the Champions League. What did you make of that Spurs side?
Well, it was a fantastic team, really. It was a well-balanced team. You know, we had Lennon on the right, who was quick, and we had Gareth Bale, who was just murdering every, could run 70, 80 yards with a ball and rip it. Unplayable, really. And then, you know, the whole makeup of the team, it was a well-balanced, good team. And, you know, I felt we could give anybody a game at that time. And we did, you know, Luka Modric was pulling all the strings in midfield, just a world-class footballer and a great person. So it was lovely. It was great. I enjoyed going in training every day, being around, working with them. It was a real pleasure. Leslie King was just an amazing footballer. It was great. It was a great time for me. You know, I loved every minute of it.
I know that your career was kind of all of these different things happening at different stages. Do you think that the best managerial work you did was that Tottenham taking them into the Champions League and then playing so well the following season?
Yeah, possibly. You know, it's difficult, really. I sort of, you know, go all the way back to Bournemouth. You know, I got Bournemouth. I got Bournemouth. They've been in Division 3 or 4 for 100 years. And people down here said, they will never go any higher. The old wives' tale was the council won't allow it. It was so silly. People actually believed that in Bournemouth. And to get into the Championship as we did was always special to me to do that. I mean, Eddie Howe came along years later and blew it out of the water to take them in the Premier. But, Tottenham was certainly fantastic. Portsmouth was a great time for me. But, yeah, I had a great team at Tottenham. I had a great team at Portsmouth, to be fair. But that Tottenham team, and I loved my time again at Tottenham. Loved it. Yeah, the football we played, the attacking football we played with two wingers and played either two up to or Rafa van der Vaart, who was a great footballer. They were just good players, good to be around, you know, and I love it. Every day you go and working with good players, good professionals, it makes the job easy.
When you were playing well and managing well and Spurs were doing great work, I remember suddenly Fabio Capello left the England job and it was like, that's going to be Harry's job. Did you start to dream about being the England manager?
Yeah, well, I looked a certainty at that time. You know, I think 10-1 on favourite. I came out of my court case and as I came out of court, it was quite amazing that it comes out that Capello's just has just resigned. It was almost as if he'd Redknapp's out now. He's got away. He's not guilty. He's going to get this job. I don't know. It was very strange timing. And then it looked, as I say, people are ringing me from the LMA and everywhere else, you know, not the LMA so much. They obviously represent everybody. They look after all the managers. But different people in the game, the FA, one or two people in the FA were ringing me saying, you know, it's your job, Harry. You know, it's your job for sure, you know. And but then,
And why didn't it happen then?
I don't know. Really out of the blue. You know, I got a phone call. I heard it on the radio. Sorry, I just heard it on the radio. I come out of Tottenham one evening after a night game gotten in my car driving. There's a new, we interrupt for a news flash. Roy Hodgson's just been appointed England manager. Good luck to Roy. He deserved it as well. You know, good luck to Roy. He'd been a great coach and manager all around the world and everywhere. So what can you do? I didn't go home and sulk. I just got, I was still lucky. I was managing a great club like Tottenham. So, you know, and I'll be honest with you, it was times I'm thinking, do I really want all that aggro? Every day, someone starting on you every day, digging you out, digging, you know, I've seen so many lovely people, great football people, ridiculed. They, you know, Graham Taylor was a great man. You know, people forget Bobby Robson had some. He got it bad, Bobby, and people forget that. You know, when he's gone, you know, people, Bobby was, when he was around, he got some grit. So I'm thinking, hang on, if they can get it, I'll certainly get plenty at once, some stage. I don't really know, you know, and I enjoyed the day-to-day going in, coaching, managing, being around players. Would I have been comfortable going up to the FA every day, sitting there in the office, watching a game once a week, twice a week? I really wasn't sure if it was for me or not, you know? Mm. So I didn't lose any sleep when it never happened.
I suppose you become philosophical anyway as a manager. You can't control whether you have a job or not. You can't control whether your players are any good or not. You know, some perform, some don't. So I guess you learn to not try and control your career too much, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I always looked at it and thought, listen, I've been so lucky. Look what I've managed. Look where I've been. Look what I've done, how many games I've managed. Look at the clubs I've been at and had a great time. There's people out there cleverer than me, never get the opportunity. There's lads in the lower division struggling to make a living. You know, great coaches, managers, just don't, you know, things just don't work. You need a bit of luck. You need a lot of luck in life as well. And I know you make your own people, but you do need a bit of luck. And sometimes things fall into place, the right time, right place. So I look, you know, I used to look at it and think, well, I've been very fortunate. There's lots of lads don't get this chance that I've had. And so I'm lucky to have done what I've done, you know, so I never I never sort of looked at it and thought, well, you know, I should have had that job or had any other job, really. I'm lucky to do what I've done, so I appreciate that.
And was there a period where the pressure did get too much? I mean, I'm thinking this is a good point. You know, this is where you're trying to do your best with Tottenham. You've been linked with the England manager's job. How do you I hear managers talk about they get consumed by the job. They can't eat, they can't sleep.
Yeah.
You know, they're awful at home. They don't have a relationship with their family because they're just constantly obsessed with the game. Did you ever allow that to happen?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I know people probably look at me and think, oh, Harry's always, you know, oh, I used to get so low. It's scary. When I look back on it, it was quite scary. It's quite scary. In that time at West Ham, when I was struggling at one time, and I had a flat in London, I used to go home and lay there on that settee and look at the ceiling for 6-7 hours after training all night. Just, I couldn't pull myself out of it. I was in a bad place, you know. And no one, but then the next day you've got to go into work and you can't show that. You've got to go in and be upbeat and everything. But deep down, it is, you know, you feel responsible for everybody, the supporters. You're letting everybody down. The buck stops with you. When you're a coach, it's different. You know, you go out, all the players like you. When you're the manager and you put that team sheet up or you pick that team, you know, the ones you ain't picking, the wives hate you, their kids hate you, their parents hate you. When you're not picking, the players hate you. It's not a bundle of fun. And, you know, it really does, as you say, it really can have a massive effect on your life. There's no doubt about that.
Well, these days, Harry, you don't deal with that pressure on a daily basis. Can we just talk about what happened at the end at Tottenham? You were consistently in the top four, did a great job there. Why do you now reflect on why it all came to an end?
I don't know, really. I don't know whether Daniel sacked me or Joe. If I'm honest, I think it's probably Joe Lewis who got rid of me. That would be my honest opinion. I think it was Joe. I think Joe decided that I should go.
Did you not get on?
I didn't know him, really. He didn't used to come to games.
Right.
He didn't used to come to games. I did get one phone call from him when I was going very, very well. And there was a bit of a discussion regarding a player that he thought shouldn't play. And that was the season I left. And I had a feeling then that my time was coming to an end there.
You had one conversation on the phone about a player that he didn't think should play.
Mm.
That's a conversation that we haven't even touched on. Owners and chairmen and board members of football clubs wanting to be managers.
Yeah. So I had a feeling then, you know, I did what I wanted to do and I didn't get swayed by his opinion or anyone else's opinion. And that was probably and then I thought, well, hang on. Yeah, this could be the end for me by the end of the season. And sure enough, it was, you know.
And you've had a few little bits since then, QPR, a bit of time in Jordan.
Yeah. I enjoyed QPR. I mean, you know, the fight, you know, getting up in the playoffs at Wembley when Bobby Zamora scored was a fantastic day, you know. To go straight back up, I took over a team that was that was full of players there, all getting 80, 90, 100 grand a week, who weren't much cop, all on long contracts. I had no chance of keeping them up when I went there, really. And then the following year to get up through the playoffs and Bobby scoring that late goal was a fantastic time. I enjoyed my time at QPR. But I was just struggling a bit at the time. Both my knees, I needed knee. I'm sitting in a chair, watch training every day. I couldn't even stand up. I was on crutches. It wasn't, I got to the stage halfway through the season. I thought, well, I don't know. I'm driving up, being, you know, I'm really didn't feel I could do the job that I wanted to do. So, that was it with QPR. But Tony Fernandes, the chairman, loved him. Great man. Lovely man. And it was a good club.
And maybe that's a nice sort of place to end this conversation, because I think in some ways you loved your time at QPR, but it was an indicator to you of how the game had changed then. Do you remember when you left and you said, I don't really know who's on my side anymore? And that was the beginning of an era where a player would have a direct relationship with a chairman or with an owner, which... It's so hard then for a manager to not be undermined.
When you know, when I was playing, Mr. Pratt, who owned the West Ham, and we had people like Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst, all them great players. Mr. Pratt was just somebody in the we just called him Mr. Pratt. Then you had Mr. Kearns, and they were just figures that you put on a pedestal. They own your football club. Suddenly, you've got players now talking to the owners, mates with the owners, you know, got a direct line to the owners. Agents, their agents have got direct line to chairman. See, football agents don't deal with managers and coaches. They deal with chairman and chief executives because they know that managers, and you're only passing through. So they set up relationships now with chairman. The chairman have all got agents who they're pals with. They listen to them. They listen to what they've got to say. And that's how it is. And chief executives have got relationships with football agents. The days that, you know, the managers don't have their relationships with, and they go direct to the chairman. You know, I left a player out one day at Man United, the player's phoned his agent, who's on to my chairman at 20-3 before the game, telling what an idiot I am. I've left him out of the team, and this is a disgrace, and why have I dragged him all the way up to the game? But that's how it's gone. They go straight to the chairman now.
So all done, Harry. 75 years old now. Never going to see you back in the dugout again?
No, never. Never. But, you know, I go every week to Bournemouth, buy me tickets. Don't ask anybody for a ticket. Take my grandkids. Harry's just joined Bournemouth. One of my grandkids is on the staff now. 16. He's doing okay. He's got a little chance. I love it. I go and watch them all play football. And I'll go and watch Bournemouth. I enjoy it. I shall be at every game this year watching and enjoying it.
Good man. Listen, it's lovely to catch up and hear all those stories and do a bit of a reminisce.
You know what? That chat really surprised me. We've heard some of Harry's brilliant stories, but the way he spoke about the pressures he used to put himself under, I thought it was really moving, actually. And I don't think we give enough credit to managers for dealing with that pressure. I can't imagine what it is like, that level of scrutiny. And all Premier League managers, however, have Sir Alex Ferguson's career as the ultimate model of success. So how about we hear from Paul Scholes, who knows Sir Alex better than most and reveals his greatest strength?
Probably handling pressure, because it was at a club. He created a mentality at a club that had to win. Probably wasn't there before he went, but he created a mentality that he had. Every player that he had to have a desire, a hunger to win trophies. I think another massive strength was rebuilding teams as well. You know, you think about teams lasting 3, 4, 5 years. He had to build 4 or 5 teams to keep coming, to keep getting stronger, to replace people. Big influences at the football club, especially in the first game. You think of Brian Robson, Steve Bruce. He had to find replacements for these, and he always managed to make sure he had that. And he had great confidence in us. He used to say at the start of every season, if you score 2 goals in every league game, you win the league. And that straight away gave you that attitude, the mental attitude of just go out and attack, just play, just try and score goals all the time. And I think from that day forward, it was something we all loved playing for. We all loved playing for him. And look, he had difficult decisions to do right through it. Of course he did. And not leaving players out isn't easy, but that's what he got paid for. That's his choice to make big decisions in big games, and he usually got them right.
So, of course, Ferguson is also famous for his hairdryer. So here's Paul revealing the worst one that he ever received.
Newcastle away. yeah, Newcastle away. I was sub, actually. We were getting beat 3-0. I came on. Maybe half an hour to go. I think we got it back to 3-2. A couple of goals. I had a couple of chances that probably should have scored. And then I gave a ball away to Alan Shearer. No, not to Alan Shearer. To a midfield player in the centre of the pitch. I tried some flick. It didn't quite work. Anyway, they went up the other end and Shearer scored. And yeah, I'll never play for this club again and all that kind of stuff. And you know, we managed to sort it out on the following Monday when I thought I was going to sign up for Oldham, but thankfully I wasn't.
Now, Rio Ferdinand, Scholes' long-term teammate, was in awe of Ferguson and the way he was able to evolve United again and again.
I just feel over the course of time, just like he knew when to turn the dial up on people or us as a team. I remember we were beating Bolton like 3 or 4-0 in the first half, playing devastating football, unreal. Opened them up, could have been 6 or 7. and you come in at half time 4-0 up or whatever he was, and he's like, oh, well done, lads, brilliant. Hey, everyone's sitting down, patting each other on the back, and he came in and absolutely went bananas, screaming at everyone. You could lose a title on goal difference, and it actually rang true years down the line. You understand why he's so like going so frantic about it, but at the time I'm sitting and go, this guy's absolutely mental. Like, we've just put on an absolute show there, a clinic of how to play attacking football, and he's got the ump. We haven't scored three because we've only scored four. Seven because we only scored four. But it just shows you that the guy just knew. He just knew the importance of remaining professional, not taking liberties, and finishing teams off, because that all the small details matter.
Well, thanks for joining us again for this Premier League storybook, for our journey through the managers of the Premier League. I think one of the most eye-opening chapters so far. Next time, we're looking at the bottom of the table and the pressures of the relegation battle. Join us for the great escapes. BT Sport Pods.